Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What essential truths can be revealed by extolling historic events through fiction? Novelist Alice Hoffman has been publishing popular works of fiction since she was 21 years old. Her two dozen novels for adults and teenagers cover a wide variety of settings and themes, but many are united by their embrace of strong, independent women who cope with the difficult realities of their lives, in part through the bonds they form with other women, and in part through a command of magical and distinctly feminine powers. Her latest book is no exception, and yet The Dove Keepers is a departure of sorts, in that its departure point is a documented historical event, referred to in the writing of the first century historian Titus Flavius Josephus. Alice Hoffman is in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. We are delighted she could make time to talk to us about her work. Alice, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So start us out, if you would, with a little background on this outpost set up by Jewish outcasts at the fortress that had belonged to King Herod at one point.
Yeah, it was built by King Herod 100 years before the siege of Masada. And for people who don't know, the Masada really was a fortress where 900 Jews gathered after the fall of Jerusalem, when they were forced out of Jerusalem. And they gathered there, and they were there for 4 years.
Hmm. And it's really interesting to read about the technology that allowed them to eke out a living for a while, at least fairly well, in this really harsh climate.
Yeah, well, one thing was that King Herod lived behind a huge storehouse filled mm-hmm. with wine and food. But the other thing is that the book is called The Dove Keepers, and it's really about four women who tend the dove cotes on the mountaintop. And the doves were really used as fertilizer so that it could be a garden up there and that food could grow.
So this ends up being one of the most important jobs in the entire fortress.
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that you found, through your research, you found artifacts, objects that make their way into the book.
Yeah. I mean, for me, what happened to me was that I went to Masada mm-hmm. and I had no idea that I would write this novel. I really wasn't the person to write this novel because I'm not a historian. I knew nothing about it. And when I went there, I had an experience that I didn't expect to have, which was I was extremely moved. I felt a spiritual connection to the place and to the people who had been there before. And there's a museum at Masada, and in that museum are the artifacts that were originally found by the archaeological team. And many of those artifacts are woven through the novel.
Mm-hmm. You know, I really like looking at antiquities in museums, but even in the best museum display case, there's something sort of sterile about those objects, even as you try to imagine where they lived. Reading about them in a novel is a totally different experience.
Yeah. It really, for me, the objects made the people come alive. Mm-hmm. And there was one exhibition that really moved me so much, and that was it was the hair and shoes of a woman who had lived at Masada, a young woman who was found beside a fountain, her remains. And that woman is one of my heroines.
What is still there? Are there structures or is it just sort of foundations?
There are structures. I mean, everything is in ruins. Mm-hmm. But the structures are amazing. You know, the Roman baths that were there, the technology that existed in the middle of nowhere. Because, of course, it wasn't the middle of nowhere, so many years ago. It was right where the King's Road ran, and that was the road that led from Damascus to Egypt. So it was a very important road, crowded, you know, filled with different cultures. And now when you go, it's just so stands alone from everything else in the world. It's such a silent place.
How did you hear about this story in the first place? Were you just sort of a tourist and you found your way to Masada, or had you read the works of Josephus?
Well, I didn't read the works of Josephus until I came back from Israel. Mm-hmm. And that was in reading the works of Josephus, that was when I discovered that there were survivors, because I'd never heard that there were survivors before. And he reports, he's the only historian of the time to tell the story. He's known to be a big liar, but he's the only one. Mm-hmm. And he says that he wrote that 2 women and 5 children survived. And the minute I read that, I thought that was my novel.
Mm-hmm. And then it's got to be hard because you've got to fill in a lot of things with your imagination, but you also have to understand everything about how people lived back then.
Yeah, which was very difficult because I wanted to write about domestic life, and there's basically not very much about domestic life. I mean, women's histories are mostly unwritten, mm-hmm. and that's where domestic life comes from. So I did the best I could. I used a lot of archaeological spines. I did a lot of research. I was a visiting scholar at Brandeis. I had use of their libraries, which was great for me. And, you know, within the context of everything I found, I created the lives of these four women.
Are historians really delighted to welcome a novelist in, albeit temporarily, and sort of share what they've learned?
Well, I'm not so sure, but, you know, the funny thing for me is I feel more of a connection with archaeology because one of the things that led me to this book is that my son is an archaeology mm-hmm. student, and he had been to Israel many times and had told me stories about the digs that he'd been on. And as he told me the stories, I began to realize, because we're so different, he's such a scientist and he, you know, doesn't read novels, but I realized that we were both interested in the same thing, which is stories, mm-hmm. and that archaeology is all about stories.
There's a little detail in the book about prostitutes having had their cost written on the soles of their shoes.
Yes.
And I just thought that was so interesting. And someone must have had to figure out why there were sandals discovered that had numbers written on them.
Yeah, absolutely. That was so interesting to me also. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that little detail was brought to me by I had a student assistant. Mm-hmm. She was wonderful because she was an Orthodox Jew who spoke Hebrew. And anytime I had a problem, she would say to me, I'll call my rabbi. Mm-hmm. So that was really helpful.
Perfect lifeline when you right. need some information. I also wasn't aware that there were Celtic peoples in this part of the world in the first century.
Well, it's so interesting because, of course, the Roman Empire, which I knew nothing about until I started to do my research, is made up of conquered people. Mm-hmm. And at the museum at Masada, there is a bit of this tartan plaid fabric. And so that is what one of my characters came alive from that. And also in museums in Wales, there are amulets from this time period from Israel. And so a character kind of grew out of those artifacts.
Okay, so let's talk about how you decided on the women who would be your primary characters. You start the book with Yael, who from the beginning, long before, you know, the Jews are expelled from Jerusalem, has had nothing but a hard life.
Yeah. She's the first voice, and she is her mother dies at her birth, and so her father despises her. And, you know, it was funny for me because she was the first character I wrote about, and I did not like her.
Really?
And I didn't expect to like her. Mm-hmm. And it really, you know, as a writer, you get to know your characters in a different way as you continue to write about them. I didn't know what her fate was going to be. I didn't know what she would mean to me personally. And my feelings about her completely changed. And in doing so, I realized that the book is very much about forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And really, that's really her fate, is to be forgiven. She's looking for forgiveness.
Yeah, initially it was hard for me to relate because, you know, I was born in the 20th century to the fact that she shares this guilt. She feels just as guilty as her father holds her guilty for the fact that her mother died in childbirth.
Yeah, she does. But I think, you know, what happens, I think, to us is, you know, we hold on to family histories and personal histories, the whole idea of ghosts in the nursery, mm-hmm. that people that we may have never even known affect our lives because we hear stories about them. And again, it's the power of stories.
So there's a thread throughout the book. One of the things Yael deals with is some things that she's done that she feels as if she is, in fact, haunted.
Yeah.
When you look at this as an artist and as now a sort of temporary historian, do you believe those ghosts are real, or are they always things that arise from within us? And does it make a difference?
Yeah, it's such an interesting area because I do believe that people are haunted. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not there are ghosts, actual ghosts that people can see or experience, you know, in some kind of real form, I'm not sure. You know, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. But I know that people are haunted by the things they do, by their feelings of guilt, by people in their families whose histories they share. I think people are haunted.
Mm-hmm. And I guess at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if it's an actual being or simply something that manifests itself to one person.
I think that's really true. I mean, for me, the best ghost story ever written is Wuthering Heights, mm-hmm. because it is completely about being haunted by someone.
Okay, so Yael finally finds her way to Masada, and mm-hmm. she's given this job, and she does not initially like the idea of working in the dovecotes because it's messy work.
Yes, it is. And she also, she's going to have to work very closely with other people, and she is not, basically not a people person. I mean, she really does not want to be with these other women. She is a loner. She keeps herself very much apart. She feels very separate from other people. And in fact, you know, part of what the book is about is the importance of friendship, because very often I think you have a relationship with a friend or with someone who's not, you know, biologically related to you that is somewhat like a mother and daughter relationship.
Mm-hmm. And it does turn out to be a sort of sorority within the Dovecotes. And these, because people are so close together, they almost can't avoid knowing everything about one another.
That's true. You know, it's a very difficult place to keep a secret when everybody knows everybody else's business. And, you know, where, you know, people lived in these tent-like situations. So you could hear everything. You were aware of everything that was going on. And yet there are still secrets everywhere.
I'm interested in the thread throughout the book of blood. And obviously, you know, the end of the story, and I don't think we're giving anything away. People can look up the history on Wikipedia of what happened at Masada. Essentially, the entire population killed themselves to avoid being enslaved once again by the
Romans.
Right. But you have blood in that regard, but then you have the, you have menstrual blood and you have blood in childbirth. And it's a very different sort of female way of looking at not only the violence of the outer world, but of the violence of our own bodies.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I really wanted to write about women in war. Mm-hmm. And I, for me, that also made it very modern. I feel like it could be going on right now, not just in the Middle East, but anywhere really, you know, where there is war and what women have to do in order to survive and in order to have their children survive. And basically, I feel like in a way, it's a sorority of blood, you know, that, and that means it's a sorority of life as well.
It's also a reminder of something that is so easy to forget living in this time, which is that childbirth used to be every single time, even under the best of circumstances, a life or death event.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I certainly felt that when I gave birth. I didn't realize it beforehand, but I thought, you know, this is very close to, life is very, very close to death.
Yeah.
You know, they walk together, and you just never know what fate is going to bring.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the question of, you know, multiple times here, there are pregnancy stories and things that are tried, you know, people try to keep things secret.
Yeah.
And it's a sense that, that the people around you always sort of know something of what's going on, even when you think you're keeping a secret.
I think that's very true. I mean, it's true now, and it was definitely true then. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, what's interesting for me in doing the research for this book is that there really was no women's history. You know, nobody wrote the book, you know, I was a temple prostitute, or, you know, it just didn't exist. And, you know, mostly because, you know, women either couldn't write or were afraid to write, and that, you know, women's tradition of history and of story is really an oral tradition.
You make several of your characters here not only literate but multilingual. Was that something that you, I mean, obviously there were some women who had education, but did you feel like you wanted to bend things a little bit just to make sure that we could relate to them?
No, I really discovered, and I was really shocked to discover how multicultural the world was then and how many languages people did speak. You know, women, you know, we don't know how many women knew how to write and what their stories were, or, you know, how much of our history that they actually wrote, because, you know, everything was done in secret really for women.
Mm-hmm. So they could have been behind more of these stories but had to conceal themselves.
Exactly.
From them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the tradition in many cases was oral, passed from one generation to the next.
Yeah. And what interested me is that I am a fairy tale and folktale fanatic. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like this is a woman's tradition as well. You know, fairy tales were begun by, you know, grandmothers telling stories to grandchildren. And I feel like magic in the Dove Keepers is told, done in the same way. Grandmothers and mothers telling daughters.
My guest this hour is novelist Alice Hoffman. Her newest work is called The Dove Keepers. She's in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. That event starts at 7:30. If you would like to join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Alice Hoffman. Her newest work is called The Dove Keepers. She's in town to speak about that and about her other writing tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art at Arts and Letters Live. The event starts at 7:30. You can learn more about it at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you'd like to join our conversation with Alice Hoffman, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Another thing this book does is remind us that divisions among people of faith and sort of different ideas about how to express that faith are nothing common only to the modern world. There were, even in the first century, even among persecuted Jews, there were different ideas about the way to worship God and to understand the world.
Absolutely. Nobody could really agree on anything. And that was very interesting to me as well, how many different kind of groups with different beliefs and different ways of acting, especially towards the Romans, you know, that some groups of Jews accepted them, felt they had to accept them, and some were assassins and refused to accept them. And it was really interesting to me because I felt like when I was writing, I was also writing about the beginnings of the Jesus movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my sense was this sect called the Essene sect, who have a lot of Christian ideas and ethics, really was the beginning of the Jesus movement.
I was really interested in that. And in fact, I went and did some research separate from the book because I hadn't known that much about them. I mean, do we know, was Jesus influenced by them? Were they influenced by Jesus?
Well, I think it was both. I think it's really both. I think it worked both ways. And certainly, I think they're very pure in their intents, mm-hmm. and in their practices. And the scrolls that were discovered, the Dead Sea Scrolls, were written by this group. And it's just a very interesting. I mean, most interesting to me is that no one really knows for sure about how people affected each other's thoughts and philosophies.
Mm-hmm. And you have in your book the Essenes writing down certain things and sort of burying them. Are we to assume those are the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yes. Well, those aren't, but there were scrolls also found at Masada and in caves around the fortress, which were Essene scrolls, which were discovered, you know, hundreds of years later.
Yeah. How long did it take? I'm curious about that process when people realized what must have gone on here. Had it been sort of left untouched for a long time?
I think it had been left untouched for a long time. And the original archaeological team, which was led by a very famous Israeli archaeologist and soldier named Jigalia Din, did the initial, with a lot of volunteers, the initial uncovering of some of these amazing artifacts that they found. And when you go, you know, there's part of this northern palace still hanging off the cliff. It's really an amazing sight. And there are all these Roman, there's still Roman mosaics and Roman paintings that are left. And it's quite an incredible journey to take.
So let's talk about your character, Revka. In the very beginning, we kind of think, well, what is her problem? And then you grow to understand her story. She's older than the other women in the story.
Yes, she is. And I feel like in writing her, I really wrote from my grandmother's voices. Mm-hmm. And for her, you know, she's living what she thinks is a perfect life. And, you know, you just never know when that's going to be disrupted. You never know when tragedy is going to strike.
Yeah, she has this really sweet romance with her husband that she's been married to forever.
Yes, she's a baker's wife, you know, and she has this romance that's been going on forever, as you say. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, one day, the Romans come to their city, their village, and everything changes.
Hmm. And she is left, according to she's caring for her two grandsons.
Yes.
And it's interesting to think about the sort of influence that she has on them, but also that they have on the way she sees the world, because she can't just give up.
That is so true. I mean, I always feel I felt that because Masada ends the way we know it's going to end, mm-hmm. with a mass suicide, I felt like it was my job to find the hope within that story. And the hope was really in the children and grandchildren and in the future. And I think that's what she sees. The reason she goes on with her life is because she has to take care of these children.
I have to ask you, I mean, knowing what happens and knowing, you know, based on the history, if you're going to follow it, that you only get to save a couple of the people that we come to care about.
Right.
I mean, were you tempted? Did you fight the urge to find a way for them all to survive?
You know, the funny thing is for me is that I knew that two women and five children would survive because that's what Josephus said. But I didn't know which of my four women would live and which would die. Hmm. And for me writing it, that was the interesting thing. Also, I was very mistaken. I thought I thought someone else was going to live who did not live. It was, you know, very difficult to write. It was very emotional. And I feel like I kind of got into their skin, that almost, you know, when you're writing a novel, it's almost like an actor becoming a role, becoming another character. You really become that person. So it was very emotional and very difficult for me.
So it's so interesting because, you know, I've talked to some novelists who have things sort of outlined and they know ultimately what's going to happen. Other people sit down and describe this process where the words just flow out of them. How does it work for you?
You know, it's funny because everybody's different. But for me, it was really both with this book. I knew the way it was going to end. I knew there'd be a siege. I knew there'd be a mass suicide. But I didn't know what was going to happen to my characters and what was going to happen to the people that, you know, you grew to love and care about in the story. So I did have an outline, but then the outline really kind of disappeared as the characters came to life. And I find that, for me as a novelist, that's how I know when things are working, when the characters start to make their own decisions.
So my favorite character in the book was Shira. I just thought she was just remarkable. Tell us a little bit about her and about her relationship to her daughters and why, for a long time, they don't understand how much she loves them.
No, they don't. And I think, you know, I'm really writing about the relationships between mothers and daughters and how fraught they are and how difficult they are and how as a child, as a daughter, you can't really know your mother. And I think that's very true. And I'm only discovering that now. And I think as you get older, especially if you lose your mother, you realize that there's so much that you didn't know about her. You know, you didn't know her as a young woman, as a girl. And I think that's what happens with Shira. She's known as the Witch of Moab. She has two daughters, but she also has relationships with other younger women who she kind of mentors and who are almost daughters to her.
And in one case, she's trying to protect one of her daughters from the kind of violence that was really common at the time.
Yeah. I think really, you know, as a parent, you're trying to protect your child, but you really can't stop them from living their lives. And in a way, that's what the book is about. You know, she knows that there's sorrow in the world. She knows they're going to have to face tragedy in their lives, and she tries to prevent it. And in fact, it does the opposite. It brings them to their fate.
And she, in fact, is still, you know, she's got these two nearly grown daughters, but she's still very young because it wasn't uncommon for women to be married off by the time they were in their early teens.
That's right. She's very, very young when she has her first child. And, you know, I think, you know, a friend of mine who read the book said, you know, are you sure you want her to be this young? And I felt like this is the truth of that life because really people didn't live that long. So their lives, you know, started much earlier in a way. They're adult lives.
I always think about that, though. What must that have been? I mean, how much more mature could a 13 or 14-year-old have been back then? I mean, some things you can't possibly learn that much in that many years. You know?
Although I think the whole concept of childhood is kind of modern. And I think people just had to grow up. You know, whether they were immigrants to this country, you know, working when they were 8 years old in a factory, or whether they were in biblical times when there really was no childhood. You really became an adult.
Yeah, there's one small scene where everything's in chaos and one of the characters asks a four-year-old girl to take a message sort of across the compound. And then it occurred to me that, you know, kids were probably working and doing things that today seem abusive to us, but were a fact of life.
Yeah. And I think it's still going on in many countries all over around the world, especially where there's war. You know, in my book, you know, young children are cleaning spears, are getting weapons ready. I mean, they live in a world of war.
One of your characters, Aziza, who is the daughter of Shira, in many ways embraces a side of herself that is more masculine than feminine. Tell us a little bit about her.
You know, I think she's my favorite character. I know you're not supposed to have favorites, but...
Well, I just told you my favorite.
Well, you know, for me, I didn't expect her to become who she was. Her section of the book is called The Warrior's Beloved, and I thought that meant whoever she was involved, the man that she was involved with, I didn't know that she was the warrior. Mm-hmm. That came as a total surprise to me. And I think it's a very interesting story because she has seven different lives within her lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, she starts out as a young girl, and then her mother feels that it's too dangerous for her to be a girl in the world that they live in. And she decides to change her into a boy, which she does.
So she dresses her as a boy.
She dresses her as a boy.
She goes to school with boys, and she's very comfortable in that world.
Right. Mm-hmm. And she wants to be a warrior, but she is a woman as well. So it's a very, very complicated life that she leads.
And I think it's also interesting that she goes to war in part to protect her younger brother, who, as the sort of man of the family, is supposed to be the one to take this on, but he's a child.
He's a child, and she has the knowledge, and she's fierce. There's something about her that's fierce. And so she's both a woman and a warrior at the same time, and she goes to save him and take his place.
Were there things that you came to in the book that you wanted to go to your next scene or your next chapter and you thought, wait, I don't know how this would have been done? And did you have to sort of stop everything and go do more research?
You know, it's interesting because I didn't do it that way. I did initial research and then I wrote. Mm-hmm. And then I would do different layers of research. I didn't want to stop myself and think, you know, what is the name of the cheese that they're eating?
Right.
You know, so I just wrote fully and then I went back and I did it in sections as well.
When you are rewriting, do you sort of have the copy of what you've done before next to you and redo the whole thing? Or do you just, you know, sort of go in with your computer and pull things out and move things around?
Well, you know, the funny thing is for me, because I started before computers, I started mm-hmm. with typewriters, I tend to write the whole thing over and over again, you know, till I'm at the very end, you know, maybe the 10th time, then I'll make little changes within the text. But I believe in redoing the whole thing because for me, it's almost like playing a musical piece mm-hmm. and you have to play the whole piece to really hear how it sounds.
Do you go back and look at things you've done at different times in your life and do you see things about yourself that have changed?
I never go back. Mm-hmm. Never go back because I feel like I would have changed so much. And I was, you know, with every book you write, you're a different person.
Yeah.
The only book I've ever gone back to was my first book because it was re-released by Farrah Straus as a Farrah Straus classic. So 30 years after I wrote the book, I went back to read it. And I thought that belongs to a different person in a mm-hmm. way.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially given that someone else might pick it up for the first time and relate fully. I mean, are there things, do people come and approach you and you've forgotten particular characters' names? Or
oh,
is that in
yeah.
your head?
No, I forget everything. The minute the book is over, I'm kind of moving on to the next book and I forget it all. I couldn't stay in that world and continue to write.
Do you have to write every day or what's your sort of schedule like?
Well, I feel like in order to write for me, I have mm-hmm. to keep doing it.
Yeah.
So when I'm into a book, I have to write every day. Otherwise, I kind of lose the rhythm and the thread of it.
Is it so much work that if you let yourself have too much of a break, you wouldn't want to go back to it?
Well, I think it's true. In a way, it's what saves me. It's mm-hmm. the thing that I love to do. It's the thing that rescues me emotionally. But in a way, I feel like I could also stop writing if I stopped writing. It's mm-hmm. it's kind of like the red shoes. You know, if you take them off, you'll just stop dancing and you won't remember how to do it anymore.
Wally Lamb said one time that every time he starts a new book, he realizes he has to learn all over again how to write a novel, which I think is such an interesting way of looking at it.
It is. I love Wally Lamb. He's such a wonderful writer and a wonderful person, and I feel exactly the same way. I never know how to write a novel. Hmm. I have to completely relearn it, and especially with this book, The Dove Keepers, I couldn't tell if it was a novel or if it was a history, or I couldn't tell if I was writing a novel or not, and I just kept doing it over and over again.
Did the voices to you sound so different from what you've done before? I mean, in so many ways, and I haven't read all of your other books, but I've read several of them. There are definitely things that appeal to me from your earlier books that I feel in this novel, but it does have a different tone.
Yeah, I think it does have a more biblical tone, you know, because I felt like I had to speak with their voices. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like if you write long enough, you realize that you have themes that keep resurfacing in your work. And I think I do write about loss and love and survivorship. And that turns out to be my theme.
Mm-hmm. You know, I told you earlier that Shira was my favorite character. Mm. We won't give anything away except to say that when you mentioned earlier that forgiveness is a big theme of this book.
Yeah.
There's a point when everything is falling apart and she sort of has a choice to make. And everybody would have understood if she had remained angry, but she chooses forgiveness. Were you on the fence about where she'd go?
You know, I didn't make that choice because, to tell you the truth, I am not a forgiving person. But it turns out that she is.
Uh-huh.
And I was really glad for her that she made that choice, because I felt like it gave her great peace to forgive the person that had really done the most hurt to her. And I think it was, she was able to do something that I probably couldn't do.
I think there's a lot in this book, too, that reminds us that relationships and families are complicated, that the
yes.
sort of white picket fence concept of what a nuclear family is in modern times and in ancient times just often wasn't the case for people. You make a family from what you have.
That's really true. I think people are so complicated. And sometimes, you know, when you have children, you expect to know them and to know them in some deep way. But sometimes, you know, you don't really know them. They're really strangers to you, and you mm-hmm. have to get to know them.
Or before they're born, you assume that you will make them like you, which
right,
turns
exactly.
out to be impossible.
Not true.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you, so you have, how many children do you have?
I have two.
Two. Do they approach your books in different ways? Like when you give them a copy of something new, do you think, okay, this is going to be a totally different read from each one?
Well, I have to say neither one of them are really readers, especially mm-hmm. my son. I mean, they're readers, but not readers of fiction. And
yeah.
especially my son, who's an archaeologist. I feel like, you know, we have a lot in common, but not the books we share. And I find that, I mean, I have to say that I'm very jealous of women who have daughters and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I really lost something in not having that. And when I'm writing, and I'm writing about women who have daughters and sisters, I'm able to somewhat experience that.
Well, it's interesting because you've been creating for yourself daughters and sisters, complicated daughters and sisters
yeah.
for 30 years.
Yeah. And I think I can do that because I had a complicated relationship with my mother and my grandmothers. And so I know what that's like, even though it can be very fraught. It's also a very rich and complex relationship.
Do you feel like you reveal who you are through the books that you write?
Completely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, you know, The Dove Keepers is really in many ways an autobiography, even though it has nothing to do with my life.
Huh.
So, you know, I think there are writers write, some writers write about their lives, and some writers are informed by the psychology of their lives. And I think I'm the latter.
And has it ever felt scary to put that out there?
No, because I think I write from such a subconscious place that I don't really know what I'm putting out there.
Uh-huh. My guest is novelist Alice Hoffman. Her newest book is called The Dove Keepers. She's in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. We're going to take your calls after the break. You can get on the line to join us now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alice Hoffman. Her newest novel out now is called The Dove Keepers. She's in town to speak tonight at 7:30 to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Anil on the line in Dallas. Hi, Anil.
Is that Anil?
Yes, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I have a question for Ms. Hoffman. I am listening to this discussion so far, and would she say this novel is fictional or is based on facts? If I am looking at New York Times bestseller list, how it will be listed?
That's so sweet. I hope it will be listed. It's definitely fiction. You know, it's a historical novel. It's based on historical facts. It's, you know, it's a story that, you know, happened. It's based on archaeological finds, but it is fiction.
Do you have a pattern in terms of what you like to read?
You know, it's funny because I started writing because I was a reader. Mm-hmm. And now I read much less because I think that writing and reading serve very much of the same purpose. And I feel like, you know, when I'm writing fiction, I don't like to read fiction because I don't want to be influenced by anyone else's style or their rhythm. So I tend to read less than I used to.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ed in Dallas. Hello, Ed.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'd like to pick up a little bit on what Ms. Huffman just said about not reading while she's writing. I'm a historian at SMU. I'm taking a break right now from page proofs of a book about black people in the American Revolutionary period. And while I was working on it, I discovered a thing called The Book of Negroes by a black Canadian writer called Lawrence Hill, who had dealt with much the same matter. And I'm really grateful that his book is 700 pages and mine is only 2 because I might get more on the market. But my question bears on 2 things. First of all, has your guest actually encountered Hill's work, and in particular this book? And I ask that particularly because he writes it from the point of view of a woman. She's taken into slavery as a girl. She tells it in flashback as an old woman. And a very bright woman student of mine told me that he gets her right. There's nothing exploitative or prurient, although there's a lot of sexuality. So I'm wondering, first of all, has your guest encountered this book? And if not, I'd recommend it. And secondly, does she ever get comments like this one from professional historians who say, yeah, you did a pretty good job there?
No, I don't know that book, although it sounds very interesting, as your book does as well. But, you know, my book just came out last week, so I haven't had that many comments generally. But I think, you know, I think I worked with a professor who was very generous to me, Richard Friedman, at the University of Georgia, and he read the manuscript. So he was extremely helpful to me. And, you know, it is fiction. It is a novel. But I wanted to get the time right.
Is there any element of your thinking that now that you – there are people who will buy an Alice Hoffman novel regardless of the subject, regardless of who the characters are. When you decided to write a book like this, did you think, let's take people who expect one thing of me and take them into a totally different place?
It's funny because I don't feel like I decided to write the book. I feel like the book came to me, was a gift to me, and I never really made the decision. And I always feel that way about my books. I feel like I'm not really making the decision. I do take notes and, you know, I am writing the book, but really the book comes to me. I don't choose the book.
Are there times when it comes to you and you think, oh, I'm not having a good time here?
Yes. I have actually found parts of books that I've forgotten about that I've started and then abandoned because you never know if it's going to work or not. And sometimes it just doesn't work.
So was it like, I mean, I am not a novelist. I have done like Afghans that I've put away for 3 years and then come back to and finished. I mean, do you have...
It's similar.
I'm
a knitter and it's actually very similar. I always think about rewriting as you've knitted a sweater and now you have to take off both arms, you know, and then re-knit them, you know. It's very much the same. And it's funny because as a knitter, so often you have to take something you love apart. You know, you've made a little mistake, but you have to take the whole thing apart. And I think that's really good practice for novelists, because sometimes you have to take the whole book apart.
That requires so much humility.
Yeah, it does, but sometimes you just need to take it apart.
How do you know when you're sort of going along, and it sounds like you like to have it down and then go back through and sort of change things. How do you know you're on the right track?
You'd never know if you're on the right track, you know. And as I said, you know, sometimes I guess I must have figured that out and put the book aside. You know, you feel it. And I think what happens is when your characters, you know, when we were talking about before, they start to make decisions, they start to feel real, they start to feel alive. That's when I think you know that it's working.
Talk about the sexuality in the novel, because there are times when it is a source of comfort, there are times when it is a source of power, and there are times when it is a source, really, of vulnerability.
Yeah. I mean, it's really true. And it was, in some ways, it was difficult to write about because, these women sometimes make choices that you wouldn't expect them to. But, you know, this is also the ancient world, and everything is at stake. Everything is very raw and brutal and passionate and in the moment. And I felt like I had to allow them to be full human beings. And part of that was being sexual beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you talk about choices, I think there's also the reality that from time immemorial, sometimes smart people do dumb things.
That's really true, especially when it comes, you know, during times of love and war.
Yeah.
I mean, they do dumb things and they do selfish things. And they do things that they later regret.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ted in Dallas. Hello, Ted.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I'm 65 and part of a brotherhood called Brotherhood of the Source.
You know what, Ted, I'm so sorry. We are, can you do us a favor, hang up, try to call again, because your signal is breaking up. We definitely want to hear your question, but the connection is not good. So call us back if you can. If you also have a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372. I'm interested that all the callers we've had today have been men.
Uh-huh.
Are there men who read your books because their wives and sisters and girlfriends love them? Or do you have just as many men, you think, engaging with your work?
I think I have a lot of male readers. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure they always come to bookstores, but sometimes they do. But I hear from them, and I have a lot of male readers. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting that when a book is about women, you know, people assume only
it's
women will read it,
only,
right?
Yeah.
When a book is about men, everyone can read it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think especially this book, I think perhaps more than any other, I think would be interesting to male readers.
Did you think about the sort of contemporary experience of women in war as you were writing this? Because we've heard so much lately about, you know, the statistics are finally out there that women are three times more likely to be victimized in war than men, even mm-hmm. though they're not directly involved in combat.
You know, I didn't think about that, but I did think about the statement someone had told me that we live in one of the most nonviolent times that it has ever been. And I thought, well, what were the other times like? You know, because I do think it's the same for women around the world. And I feel that they're more in danger than men because they have so much to protect. So, you know, the funny thing is when I started writing, I thought, you know, I can never write a great novel because I can't write about war. Hmm. And what I realized in writing about this novel is that I can certainly write about war.
Let's go back to the phones now. Hopefully we have a better connection with Ted in Dallas. Hey, Ted.
Hey there. Can you hear me now?
Absolutely.
Well, good. I had to go outside.
Thank you for
Anyways,
doing that.
Anyways, Ms. Hoffman, I want to congratulate you on your novel. I think it's a real important piece and probably a lot more factual than you're letting on. I was a member of an Assinian Brotherhood in Los Angeles in the 70s. And my teacher was from everything that we knew, was an ancient Essenian. And he spoke a lot about the Essenes and Masada. One story he related was of a woman like Azimuth?
Oh, Aziza. Aziza, who's
Aziza,
a warrior, yeah.
Yeah, similar to what you said, had been raised as a boy and was a warrior. And the story he related in Masada was that she had gone down to the Romans with three or four other men from Masada to tell them that they would not take them alive. She was the spokesperson of the group that went down and talked to the Roman general. And she put her hand out and... Or she put her arm out. She said, and to show you what I mean, she put her arm out, and one of the others, and she was given a sword, and she cut her arm off, or the lower half of her arm off, and handed it to the general. And then they left.
Interesting story. Well,
that was that, the lady that you talked about reminded me of that story. Hmm. And by the way, Mary was raised, Mary, Jesus' mother, was raised in the Essenian settlement by the Dead Sea.
That's
and
so interesting.
Joseph of Arimathea was also an Essenian, although he didn't live there at the Dead Sea.
Wow. Thank you for that insight. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your comments. I really appreciate it. It's a very interesting story because in my book, actually, I don't want to give too much away, but there is a similar situation to the one that you described. So that's very interesting. It may be the collective unconsciousness. I don't know, because there's certainly no actual factual reports of this. But that's a very interesting story.
It's interesting, too, when Bill brings back up the story of Aziza, one of the things that changes in her life is her name on multiple occasions. And it made me think about this, that, you know, certainly as parents, we choose our children's name with great care.
Yeah.
But throughout this story, the assignment of names is really important. And that must be something you relate to as a novelist because you have a sense of what's going to happen with your characters, or at least who they are.
Yeah. And there is a Jewish tradition that if you change your name, you change your fate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what happens to these characters. And I think names are so important in helping you become who you are. And it definitely is for the character of Aziza. You know, it's interesting because there are women in war and women who dressed as men throughout time who went to war. And it was, I think, you know, for my character, it's the only way she can really be free to be her true self.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Nancy in Garland. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
The question for your guest. I had heard of your work, but I apologize that I hadn't read any of them. However, I do have a question. It's probably more of a general question for an author.
Okay.
I'm looking at a review that a lady on the Boston Globe did in 2009 on one of your earlier works, The Story Sisters, and it's very unflattering, and I have a hard time believing it, listening to you talk today about your newest book. Do you have any comments about that in general?
Do you read reviews? You pay attention?
You know what? I don't. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I don't think it's a good idea. And actually, I worked for a while. I've also been a screenwriter for 20 years, and mm-hmm. I worked for a while with Diane Keaton, who I think is such a great actress and a great person. And she said to me that she had never read a review of her work because she said to me, look, what happens is the good ones you don't believe,
mm-hmm.
and the bad ones, you know, stay in your head and you can't get rid of them. So it's better not to read them at all.
Yeah, it is strange sometimes to think about, and now, you know, with the internet and people, you know, write just voluminous praise or just incredibly vitriolic criticism. And I suppose, you know, book critics are in a separate category, but there's that sense that the real person will never pay attention or can't be bothered by it.
Well, you know, I think the thing is that when you start out as an artist, you have to decide who you're going to believe and who you're not going to believe. Otherwise, I think, you know, you'd have voices in your head that would stop you from working. For me, with The Dove Keepers, the most important thing was that Toni Morrison gave it a quote. After mm-hmm. that, I don't really care what anyone else says because I am a huge fan mm-hmm. of hers, yeah.
Do you have a specific person that you're writing to, or is that different with every book, or is it really only an exploration of what you're thinking?
You know, I don't really think about anybody ever reading it.
Really?
And I think that frees me up mm-hmm. in a way. But when I wrote The Dove Keepers, every once in a while, I would think about the person that I used to be and the person who wanted to be a writer. And every once in a while, I would think, I think she would like this book.
Do you plan to do more historical fiction in the future?
I plan to, but of course, and I'm doing research, but of course, you never know what's going to happen. I never know which book will live and which book won't. But I really enjoyed it, I have to say.
And I guess there's research that goes into even books that happen in contemporary times.
Absolutely. I wrote a book called The Ice Queen, which was about someone who was struck by lightning. So I had to do a lot of research about weather. And, you know, so, you know, really, I think every novel is, in a way, a research project as well.
Do those facts stay in your head?
Not at all.
Same as what you've written about. Well, Alice Hoffman, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. So nice to talk to you.
Alice Hoffman's latest novel is called The Dove Keepers. You can see and hear her speak tonight at 7:30 at Arts and Letters Live. The event takes place at the Dallas Museum of Art, and you can find more information at dallasmuseumofart.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.